Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Today we're going to talk about Giovanni da Correggio, or also sometimes referred to as Giovanni Mercurio, if you want to look him up, or Giovanni Mercurio da Correggio, any of those kind of variables. Is that a variable?
It's a variable.
Any of those combinations?
Right, and you could probably try to track him down. He's a very interesting character we have on the show tonight.
Yeah. So, I mean, he talks about the Philosopher's Stone, which we'll get into, but the interesting character part, there was quite a while when people thought he was fictional, because the stories about him are so far out there that people didn't actually think that this was a real guy until they started to come up with you know, other documents or other sources that would corroborate some of these stories. But in any case, he was born around 1450. We're not really sure. And he was the bastard son. Let's say he was the illegitimate son of Antonio da Correggio, who lived until 1474. And now, this Antonio was a person belonging to high nobility of Bologna. Okay, so what makes him interesting to us is that he wrote on Hermeticism and was kind of a pseudo-Lullian alchemist. We just did an episode on Ramon Lull, right? So that's why I chose this guy. And he had an interesting pupil who may have actually started him on his road to alchemy, which was Ludovico Lazzarelli, who lived from 1447 to 1500. And so that was kind of his apprentice and his pupil. Why don't you give us one of the really crazy stories?
Well, so one of these stories will take us back to Palm Sunday in 1484. Correggio made his second public appearance in Rome. The spectacular event was described in detail by Lazzarelli in an anonymous tract called the Epistola a Enoch. So here's the story. He rides through Rome wearing rich garments, all bedecked and with four servants in tow. He gets out of the city and he changes into blood-stained linen and a crown of thorns. He has a crescent moon-shaped silver-plated disc around his head, kind of foretelling some of the maybe the artistic renderings of angelic or patron saints that you might see in the art of the time. And so he's also saying that he's God or Jesus' servant, Pedander. He gets out on a white donkey and enters the gates of Rome again. Again, this kind of gives you an idea of what Jesus did when he came into the city of Jerusalem on a donkey, to be modest.
Yeah.
And he's surrounded by all his servants on horseback. On his way to the Vatican, he stops here and there to proclaim the coming judgment while identifying himself as Giovanni Mercurio di Correggio, the angel of wisdom, Pedander.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm trying to put this in my mind. It does sound like something very fanciful to see this guy come in, and heretical at
well,
the same
that's
time,
the thing.
It?
This is dangerous. This is, yeah. To make it even worse, or kind of to up the appearance even, so as people are, this is on Palm Sunday, right? So as people are leaving the churches, they're holding in their hands the palm branches that they get in Mass, right? So it's like, it's exactly like the scene from the Bible. This guy's walking in on a donkey and everybody has palm branches in their hands. And so, you know, just to see what was going on, they start following to the streets. And so it's really like, just like out of the Bible. And except that, you know, Christ was in Jerusalem, but, you know, this same idea. So Lazzarelli then tells us that the guards at the gate of St. Peter made way for him and allowed him to kind of, you know, to enter. And so even though the church was still full of people, including, you know, high officials, like high church officials and everything, and so he gets off his donkey and then he walks up to the altar and he kind of offers up his mystical apparel and a paper entitled The Eternal Gospel. Then he prays to God and leaves St. Peter's. Okay, so that's one version of the story. A contemporary Jewish author, whose name was Abraham Farisol, he writes that at one point Correggio was imprisoned in Rome. So even though Lazzarelli describes him as entering and leaving with, you know, no problems at all, that doesn't make sense. I think you'd have a lot of issues if you walk up to St. Peter's dressed as Jesus on Palm Sunday,
the only
right?
thing that makes me think that he could have pulled this off, and the first story might be possibly correct, is that during Palm Sunday, much like when you see today, people, especially in Italy, will have self-flagellation when it comes to
Easter.
Yeah, so they
thought it was just like a procession.
A procession, yeah. Like someone must have passed this, someone must have given permission for this, because this guy would be crazy and heretical if he was actually pulling this off without permission. So, come on in. So, probably knowing this, he probably said, well, this is a great opportunity to kind of leave what I want to leave at the altar and then just get out of Dodge.
Man, who knows what he was thinking. But according to a different story or a different source, that he never actually made it to the altar, that he barely escaped, or that he was actually, one was that he was imprisoned and then he fled together with his friends and kind of devotees. In any case, he fled to Bologna, where he's from, and then he was imprisoned anew on suspicion of heresy, but apparently released because then, you know, we have further history of him. Okay, so give us another one.
All right, well, you know, at this point, you know, we're looking at the year 1486, and Correggio made another prophetic appearance, this time in Florence.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so as you can imagine, this is still in the middle of Italy, and of course, at a time where you really don't want to be rocking the boat of the church. He was on his way to the court of King Ferdinand I in Naples. He had requested to see him. So here's this guy, Correggio, requesting to see Ferdinand I.
Yeah.
Right? Undoubtedly at the suggestion of Lazzarelli, who had recently arrived in Ferdinand's court. But Lorenzo El Magnifico ordered Correggio arrested and imprisoned as a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so he was severely harassed and by a Franciscan inquisitor. So now we got the Inquisition involved in this.
Yep.
All right, so this is kind of bad news. But King Ferdinand obtained his release, and we don't know whether Correggio ever made it to Naples at this point. So, again, you might have to take this with a grain of salt. All right? So,
yeah.
You know, I think at this point, this guy's probably making a name for himself.
I mean, many people thought these were completely made-up stories.
Well, maybe as we're going forward with this is that people tend to embellish, all right, as time goes on, saying, did you hear what, you know, Correggio did this week? Oh, my goodness. He went to Ferdinand's court, right,
yeah.
On his own, you know, or he was invited. Now he somehow got out of the Inquisition's hands, and he's still alive. He's still doing okay. He maybe become a folk hero. You know, these type of things kind of build upon themselves.
Yeah, well, his delusions of grandeur get even bigger. In fact, so a couple years later, we got a story from 1492. He visited Rome, this time with kind of a bigger following, and he started calling himself the Younger Hermes. And in 1497, he preached in Venice. In 1499, he passed through Cesena on his way to Milan, but this time kind of like as a hermit. So he's all humble, dressed in sackcloth. Now here's the thing. So before, bedecked in gold, like some 15 years earlier, and now, he might have not been pretending. He actually might have been this poor. He actually might have lost his fortune somewhere. So, because he was on his way to Milan, he's accompanied by his family, basically his whole household, five children. And in 1501, he traveled to Lyon, still with his family, where he obtained an audience with King Louis XII. He kind of managed to impress him with his knowledge and his wisdom and all this, and especially with the promise of, you know, giving him alchemical secrets, like how to make gold and even magical secrets and that kind of thing. Then, you know, we kind of lose track of him a little bit, but later he appears in Rome again.
And this time with an alchemical cure against the plague.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Right. So now he's a great healer.
Now he's dabbling in medicine.
Right.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to break down a little bit was a work of art by him called De Querco. I think that might be how you pronounce it. So we'll kind of break that down a little bit. So Correggio was, in fact, more successful than Lazzarelli in getting stuff printed, okay? Now, during the last part of his life, I mentioned that he was wearing sackcloth and moving around with his family. Now, it does look like he actually lost his fortune, and with his family, they were roaming the streets as beggars. There's one thing published in 1499, which is an oration printed in two colors in the form of a cross, and a long text that says, against the barbarians, the Turks, the Scyths. And so this was in his visit to Lyon. Now, there's another interesting thing, and this is called De Querco, which was addressed to Pope Julius II. At this point, we think he's a beggar, and he's basically trying to impress upon the Pope how awesome he is and what kind of knowledge he can give the Pope if only the Pope would help him, like, you know, financially, somehow get back onto his feet. So, yeah, why don't you break this down for us? Like, what is De Quercus?
So in De Quercus, he addresses the Pope Julius II, whose real name before he took the vows was Giuliano del Rovere, who reigned as Pope from 1503 to 1513, to give you kind of a context of his time. But del Rovere means of the oak, and the oak is prominently put upon the seal of Julius' coat of arms, and it provides Correggio with the ruling metaphor for his text, which he really never stops talking about, which is the supreme magnitude, the beauty, the power of the Pope and its oaks and its branches jutting out from one direction to the other, and its luster, like running through light through the universe. You can definitely tell that at this point that Correggio is really trying to ingratiate himself to the Pope.
Yeah.
All right, he's really no holds barred. This guy may not be stupid, but he's crafty.
And he's poor.
You know, and when you're poor, if anybody's ever been poor, you scratch harder. You scratch and claw a little harder, don't you?
Yep.
Yeah. You know, so he wrote things like Tris Megistical and Mercurial, and compared things to a phoenix, referring them all this to Hermes Trismegistus and the alchemy background that he had. So this is where it kind of comes in for this podcast tonight.
Like one way he uses the word phoenix is, he says, descends from heaven to earth by the way of putrefaction and resolution, separation and purification. It's almost like he's reading an alchemist cookbook.
Well, yeah,
putrefaction,
we're talking about decay. Resolution, we're talking about maybe the hardness or toughness of a metal or of gold.
Yeah,
right?
This is all like steps in creating
separation,
gold. Yeah.
Dissolving, and then purification.
Yep.
Know, achieving what you need to achieve in alchemy.
Yep.
Right.
And and then he goes on with his phoenix analogy, and he says how, you know, so it burns and then it returns. And now he starts talking about, like, we haven't really done a podcast on this, but it's important. It's on my website if you want to read more about it, but the primary matter, like the first matter, this is like really big in alchemy. And he keeps talking about like primary and primordial nature, quintessence, which is, you know, kind of like the fifth element. And, he talks about chaos, heil, pure, informal, universal matter of nature. This is all going back to the first matter. Then he goes on about, he talks about the genius of geniuses, the form of forms, the general seed of all the world, again, talking about quintessence or the first matter. And then it kind of gets Neoplatonic, because he talks about the world spirit, the end of the egg, the great triple stone. You know, so triple stone is like, you know, mineral, vegetable, animal. And then, you know, philosopher's stone, it's a stone and no stone. It's found in any place on earth and in any man, which is, again, yeah, very hermetical and that kind of thing. It's found in everything. It's held by both the rich and the poor, and can be changed into every color, any nature, complexion, with which this stone is brought into conjunction. Okay, so that's a snippet of that text. So again, speaking of the first matter, when you would basically break whatever you're doing down, you know, mostly sulfur and sulfur salts, sulfur and mercury, and then build it back up into living matter, which is Aristotelian science, the philosopher's stone, the fifth essence, right? That kind of thing. When he talks about the philosopher's stone, he says it can do very many things. Like what would that be?
Well, turning imperfect metals into perfect gold and silver, for one.
That's probably the main one, right?
It can also turn crystal and common glass into precious stones and gems. It can also produce a special kind of flexible and malleable sort of glass. Another option, you can
like
also
plastic. It can make plastic.
I guess he was the first plastics guy, there. So you can probably do that as well. He can turn pearls and gems and gold into the most precious, and potable liquor, or universal medicine, right? Which is, a lot of people were talking about alcohol at the time that would cure a lot of things, right? So that'd be part of that as well. It also causes trees to give fruit 12 times a year. It can turn an ordinary apple tree into a tree of life.
There you go.
All right, solving world hunger there on the forefront. It can also cure all diseases, restore a man to perfect health and youth. It can also bring a man back from the very threshold of death if, God allows it.
Yeah, you know, that's, he's writing to the Pope, right?
Right, so you can't. Yeah, let's be careful when you're writing to the Pope. It can also make a man immune to heat and cold, and permits him to live without need of ordinary food, drink, or sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So you can even go further than the human body can push its limits. Can make you Superman. By means, it can also attract any beneficial constellation and influence from the stars. So this is where we bring in the astronomy and the astrology, possibly.
So it could actually change the meaning of
it. Well, he is covering his bases on this, isn't he? it also means you can also find hidden treasures, acquiring the perfect knowledge of the occult mysteries, as well as every art and to learn everything you can know about things hidden, known and unknown.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's really, it's going to be a gateway key to everything you can think of. Really, it's probably put this on a pedestal, hasn't it, you know, at this point?
Yeah. What I think is interesting is that, because I've read many alchemist descriptions of the Philosopher's Stone, this is one of the, how do you say, like, most inclusive?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, this is like the ultimate, not just universal medicine, but, you know, because some would say it's one or the other. You know, some would say, okay, it'll give you eternal life, or others would say it can turn stuff to gold. But he really covers all the bases.
He does, and he has one more point that I think is really kind of important to ingratiate himself with the Pope. It also allows a person to be anywhere at will by one's own strength and in a very natural sort of way. It means that the Pope can break chase away with any instantly with any ways to exterminate the armies and powers of the Turks. So now he's bringing in the things that are really bothering the Vatican at the point, which are the outside forces trying to come in and take territory, which would be the Turks. Mohammedans and all pagan nations with all needs of weaponry and without a great army.
So he can just will them gone.
He can will them gone. So he is covering his bases, and you know, by saying that this Philosopher's Stone can do anything and everything you possibly dream of.
What's interesting about this is, so he insists, maybe because he's talking to the Pope, I don't know, but he insists that this does not go against the course of nature, right? So he actually says it's not through spells or kind of magical or Kabbalistic art. Like, that's a quote. So he actually says, like, no, this is, you know, all on the basis of nature, and, you know, by nature, through nature. This is all, you know, this is all on the even. Nothing weird happening here.
And by the way, this is the, you know, the safety sort of term at the end of that statement. All this works with the Philosopher's Stone if God wills it.
Yeah.
If he doesn't will it, it's not going to work.
Right.
Yep. All right, so that also covers his tailbone, you know, so that he doesn't look like a charlatan if it doesn't work. You know, and it also basically covers himself from being called a heretic.
Yeah, one more thing. He did kind of a nod to Hermes by saying that it perfects man beyond and above nature. So even though it's natural, you know, there's kind of hermetic. There's hermetic things kind of sprinkled throughout this, just in his language. Yeah, basically, you know, if Julius accepts his thing, he would basically get superhuman knowledge and power. So
how could you turn it down?
Yeah, he also, like, another thing he said that it does is that it can gives you the power of prophecy. So you can know all things of the past, all things, you know, all things of the future. You'll have, like, a certain clairvoyance, like, you'll know the subtle meanings of words, you'll know the solutions of arguments, like, you'll know what to say to win an argument, you know. And then, you know, like, he kind of goes into divination, like, you'll, you know, again, back to the prophecy thing, but, you know, basically you'll be able to see the outcomes of the centuries ahead and that kind of things, even the changes of customs. Yeah. And then, you know, back to astrology, like the dispositions of the stars, so you'll be able to look up and instantly read the stars, like, you'll just, it'll be like reading English, or in his case, Italian. And so pretty interesting stuff. He goes on, though. We're not done yet. Then he says that you'll understand the properties of stones, the virtues of elements, the natures of animals, like, you know, the force of the weather. Like, you'll understand winds and possibly even read the thoughts of men. Like, you'll understand the thoughts of men. So all things that are hidden, you kind of mentioned this before, like, all things that are hidden, you'll thoroughly know, you'll learn. And he compares that to Solomon, like, you'll just understand things. To quote him one more time, he says, "Therefore, all obscurity will flee from you. All your darkness will be illuminated as at midday, and you too will conquer all the hosts of pagans and Turks," like you said, "not in strength of body nor in might of armor, but with the word, the spirit, and the rod of virtue." Yeah, now at the end of this whole thing, he does kind of ask for money. So he's like, "Yeah, I can give you all this stuff.
Here's the rub."
But dude, yeah, but man, I'm starving out here. One source I read said that he was really in dire straits. Like he was weeks away from starvation. He had five kids, so I mean, he had a lot of food to put on the table. And yeah, he just wasn't quite making it.
Well, you know, one thing, Travis, I look at this, and there was one thing that stands out to me here that wasn't mentioned that the Philosopher's Stone could do, and that's tell the future. You know, I mean, yeah. And I think he had to be very careful with that because that becomes a soothsaying situation.
Yeah, I've never heard
and that
any
is
of
heretical.
This. Well, that's why he said it's natural.
Right.
It's like, but don't worry, it's all natural.
Right.
It's,
but I think any leader would want to say, well, what's going to happen in my future so I can see if I can change it? At that point, you're dabbling more into not a religious art so much as something that deals with the occult.
One source I mentioned points out that it's possible in certain, like at one point he mentioned, like, as I met you years before. And so it is possible that he had actually met the Pope before he was the Pope. So he might have actually took a bigger risk here, saying, like, remember me? Like, I'm the guy that impressed you that one time. Well, now me and my five kids are starving, you know? So because he might have known him personally, he kind of went out on a limb and say, you know, took a bigger risk, let's say. Because I think if you wrote this kind of thing on the run from the Inquisition at one point, and writing this kind of thing to the Pope, that's really playing with fire. But apparently he didn't get the Pope's buy-in. So apparently they died poor beggars on the street.
You know, when we talk about him, you know, it sounds like Reggio was like a used car salesman, you know, with a hard sell.
Yeah.
All right, you know, I mean, he did a lot of things to kind of prop up his persona, and it sounds like he really tried really hard to try to make a quick buck, but never really an honest buck, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, the end result is you die poor and penniless and you know, starving. You know, I think that maybe if he would have had, you know, different idea about what he wanted to do at the tail end of his life, instead of trying to really kind of sell the Pope on this kind of grandiose idea, then, you know, he might have survived.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's hard to figure out exactly where he went wrong. I mean, he was clearly out there. But apparently before he met his pupil, he was kind of just a really radical preacher, just like a doom, you know, apocalypse is upon us kind of, you know, the end is nigh kind of guy. And but he came from a rich family, and then I guess he just kind of squandered it away, and possibly with alchemical pursuits. There's not a lot known about him. And like I mentioned at the beginning, he was considered fictitious for centuries because what was known were these stories, and it was just until it was corroborated by enough sources that they said, oh, you know, this guy was probably real. They just thought, okay, this is a nice story. This guy's way too crazy to have actually existed. But yeah, I would say he's real. This really happened. As crazy as that might seem. So that's all we have tonight for you. So thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter @AlchemyPodcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on Bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.